This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past and present and recognise their continuous connection to culture. We would also like to thank the people of Norfolk Island, Aotearoa New Zealand and the Pacific for allowing their stories to be told.
You have the address?
All I have is the LinkedIn profile that I emailed you there.
I think the girl who could do the job is Alice.
I'm talking with Eddie Anuve, a documentary maker, who's suggesting someone he thinks can help me track down a man in Lyon. I'm pretty sure the man's one of the agents on board the Uvea. Etienne recommends a contact of his, Alice.
She has really a very clever way to approach people and to make them very confident with her. So I think if she approaches, she can be the good girl to do the job.
The man I'm looking for has never spoken publicly about his role in the Rainbow Warrior affair. If his LinkedIn profile's accurate, he's a good fit in terms of age and experience. 13 years in France's combat diver troops, TIC, security advisor to the CEO of one of France's biggest companies, TIC. Most recently, part of an economic intelligence firm, TIC. Even the guy's profile pic looks like one of the mugshots I've been staring at for the last 12 months as I research the case. Hopefully Alice can help get me in touch, because I've got lots of questions I want answered. Questions like, could he believe that he and his fellow agents were allowed to simply sail away from Norfolk Island? What happened to the Uvea? Does he feel any guilt for the death of Fernando Pereira? Was he worried he might go to prison for murder? This is Fallout, spies on Norfolk Island.
And then eventually we briefed to do a search for the Uvea.
I remember getting the radio link and then that call just stopped in mid-sentence.
Why did they continue to lie when we knew that the Uvea carried agents from the DGSE? Still, they kept on lying.
Episode 5, The Bully. It's spring in Australia, 1985. With France's dirty secrets spilling out for the world to see, some of Australia's best journalists sense there's a story hiding on Norfolk Island. Geraldine Brooks is one of them.
They tracked the boat and we knew it had gone to Norfolk Island and then been allowed to go, but we didn't know what had happened there. So I just flew from New Zealand then to Norfolk Island to see what I could find out.
Politicians are getting in on the act too. The leader of the Australian Democrats at the time, Don Chipp, is doing his best to keep the bastards honest by asking some curly questions in Parliament. Keep the bastards honest was his party's catchy slogan in those days. Everybody wants to know why the French agents weren't held on Norfolk for longer. Has Australia gone soft on France? This is where the big cache of documents I found in the National Archives delivers. They help tell the untold story of what's going on behind the scenes in Bob Hawke's Australian government as it deals with the scrutiny. And one man in particular seems to be getting worked up about it all. Norfolk Island's administrator, John Matthew. On Monday, October 9, 1985, he calls a senior public servant in Canberra after hearing a whisper about something that's about to go down in Parliament. The public servant makes a written note of their conversation.
Administrator rang at 1:30 p.m. to say he heard that Senator Chipp is asking questions. He asked we keep a listening watch and tell him of developments. The whole thing is becoming very complicated.
Journalist Geraldine Brooks is also in his sights.
The administrator, Norfolk Island, rang to say Geraldine Brooks, reporter for the National Times, is on Norfolk Island seeking information on the Uvea. The administrator has advised Brooks that he has no comment. He said that she had seemed to misrepresent her prior contact with the minister's office.
I think they were very disappointed that I showed up.
Back in Auckland, Detective Inspector Morris Witham has worries of his own. He's handling the paperwork for the biggest murder trial of his career, with Alain Mafar and Dominic Prieur due to face court in November 1985.
All this evidence, 181 witnesses, all the statements were prepared.
If drowning in paperwork isn't enough, Morris and his colleagues also fear France's security services are plotting more hostile action.
There was all these rumours about them being sprung from prison. It had happened previously with DGS agents who were arrested in Algeria. They were busted out of prison.
So you were actually concerned the French would mount like another operation to extract these guys?
Yes. And there was talks of submarines off the coast of New Plymouth. There was talks about all sorts of things.
Alain Mafar is moved into a maximum security prison as a precaution. More drastic measures are required for Dominic Prieur, also known as Sophie Tourange.
The army decided that they would set up a special prison at the Papakura military camp. So they had a special building set up. They put wire fence around it, electrified it, razor wire on the top, and they flew her in by the equivalent of Black Hawk helicopter from Christchurch. It wouldn't put her on a commercial flight in case something went wrong. And she arrived in this compound to the surprise of machine gun, black-clad men and trees and all sorts of things. And she was kept in this security compound guarded by our SAS. So they had a special hall facility for her so that she couldn't be busted out.
It might seem over the top, like a bad action film plot, but until the Rainbow Warrior bombing happened, nobody in New Zealand would have thought a supposedly friendly country would send its spies to blow up a ship moored in its biggest city. The Kiwis even built a special armoured vehicle to take the pair to and from court,
which we dubbed the Tourangemobile. It was bulletproof. It was able to withstand landmines and all the rest of it.
Anticipation in New Zealand reaches fever pitch at the start of the French pair's murder trial.
It's going to be something like a 12-week trial, a hearing trial.
The High Court of New Zealand is specially renovated for the occasion. There's 150 local and foreign journos camped outside. Everyone is hungry for more secrets of this disastrous sabotage operation to emerge. But there's been movement behind the scenes.
There was a lot of negotiation went on the weeks before the trial.
And Morris is one of the few people in New Zealand who knows that the show will be over before it begins.
And they would plead guilty to manslaughter. So there was about three or four people knew about it.
Politics and diplomacy have crept into the case.
I went down on the morning of the court case to the district court, laid a new information for manslaughter for the two of them, and took it back up to the High Court. So we go into court, I bring the new informations, lay the new informations in the file in court, and this whole day lasted like 10 minutes. They pleaded guilty and walked out.
Talk about a letdown. Alain Mafar and Dominic Prieur were filmed entering their guilty pleas. But New Zealanders were denied seeing the footage, with the agents taking legal action, claiming the vision would breach their privacy. Finally, in 2006, 21 years after the bombing, New Zealand's Court of Appeal ruled that the guilty pleas could be shown.
The tapes have lain in the High Court vaults. Some even have mould on them. The potential for damage to the tapes over two decades was very real.
How do you plead guilty or not guilty?
But the footage of the historic court hearings has survived.
A few weeks after pleading guilty to manslaughter, Alain and Dominique are sentenced.
10 years imprisonment in New Zealand.
But France is already working on another plan to set them free.
If the official response to Geraldine Brooks's presence on Norfolk was frosty, the locals were more welcoming.
it was very easy to ask around, and everybody was talking about it, of course. It was like the hot topic. So I went to the hotel where the guys had checked in, and before the police tracked them down there, one of the young girls who was working in the bar said, you know, they really stood out because this is a geriatric resort. And also, they were just terrible. They just hit on every female that came in their way. So everybody was noticing them and paying attention to them. So I wanted to talk to the island administrator about why they'd not held them, because I talked to the police who'd been involved in the interrogation, which lasted all night, and he wanted very badly to keep them.
Geraldine didn't get anywhere with the administrator, though.
I had tried to contact the administrator and got stonewalled, so I lobbed up at the front door of the residence. I don't know if that's noted in the...
That's not noted, no. What happened? How was your reaction? Did you get past the door?
I was given the bum's rush, yes. What's sort of shocking in retrospect these days is how long it took Interpol to check the passports, because if Interpol had done their job, the fake passports would have been revealed. Like, three of the four were fake. The doctor's was genuine.
So what did the documents from the National Archive tell us? Why did Australia give the Kiwi police on Norfolk Island just 13 hours to find evidence against the French agents? Remember, almost half a day had been chewed up by assembling the police touring party, finding a plane, and getting to Norfolk. As we know from the report written by Norfolk Island Police Sergeant Paul McIntosh, the island's administrator John Matthew set the deadline after consultation with the Attorney General's department in Canberra. I'd love to see a record of those discussions, but unfortunately I don't have them. Perhaps the most telling document I do have is a handwritten memo from September 1985 by a senior Home Affairs official. He wrote that government complaints about media coverage of the events on Norfolk Island risked, quote, opening up an area of potential criticism.
It's not at all clear from the faxes why the administrator set this time as a deadline, or why the deadline was necessary. As I read the Police Offences Ordinance, e.g. Sections 9, 11 and 13, the NI Police have quite wide power to hold suspects.
This bears repeating. The Norfolk Island Police have quite wide power to hold suspects. If this official's view is right, there was no need to set such a tight deadline for the Kiwis. Australia could have, if it wished to, dragged things out. Because I don't think the French government knew at this point that the Uvea crew had been detained on Norfolk. Another Home Affairs document from 1985 also raises doubts about the extent of the Norfolk Island administrator's powers.
The draft touches on a delicate issue vis-a-vis whether the administrator has power to direct Norfolk Island police officers.
While none of this is a smoking gun to say Australia deliberately set the Kiwis up to fail in order to appease France, it does beg the question, why didn't Australian authorities do more to help? Why weren't the Frenchmen's passports taken and not returned until their bona fides had been checked? I asked Dennis Murray, the federal police officer serving on Norfolk Island at the time, if he had the feeling that games were being played at a level way above his pay grade.
You shake your head, you think, oh, shit. But then, of course, all the stories are of the political interference, especially when it was sort of intimated that our governments were dictating the terms, whether it be Australian or New Zealand, you know, not letting you get on doing your job, right?
And Geraldine Brooks?
Everybody was worried about trade, and never mind that a man died. I thought the whole thing was really disgusting at the official level.
So it's launch day of episode one, Fallout Spies on Norfolk Island, and I'm actually on the road again in country New South Wales.
Good morning, I'm Richard. How are you?
Good morning, I'm Joan.
Hello, Joan. Lovely to meet you. Thank you for allowing me to come into your home.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Come out of
the room. It's a bit chilly, isn't it?
Freezing wind.
Oh, good morning. These are for you as well, for some morning tea. I stopped in your beautiful cake shop.
Oh, that's really sweet.
I'm not sure what you like, so I just got a selection of things there.
Would you like tea or coffee?
Actually, a black tea would be lovely, to warm up.
Weak or strong?
Oh, pretty strong.
Throughout the making of this podcast, I've been fascinated about the part Norfolk Island Administrator John Matthew had played in the Rainbow Warrior affair. By my calculation, he'd be pushing 100. So never did I think that he may still be kicking. And if he was, I didn't expect he'd be willing, or maybe even able, to talk. I was wrong. About to turn 97, John's sharp and sprightly as he pops up out of his armchair to greet me. As we chatter over a hot drink and cake, it takes me no time to realise the man I'm talking with has had a remarkable working life in the service of Australia.
I was brought up in a rather lonely background, and the Navy provided a wonderful outlet for me at the age of 13. I joined the Royal Navy and spent the next few years in the North Pacific. I was there just after the atomic bomb, and we saw the devastation in its prime.
John went on loan to the Malaysian Navy to stop the surge of Chinese communists from the north. Then he was given command of his own ships before being posted to the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C., at a tumultuous time in American history.
I became the Assistant Defence Attaché for 4 years. It was wonderful because it was the height of the Vietnam War, and we had access to the highest levels of American intelligence.
Were you there then during the Watergate?
Oh, yes.
With Nixon?
In fact, they put us up at the Watergate when I arrived there, in the suite almost next door to that.
Oh, wow.
Returning to Australia, John joined the spy world as Director of Defence Intelligence.
Did you ever have a view on the extent of Soviet penetration of Australian intelligence at that period?
All I will say is that there were several more Australians were Soviet assistants than have ever been named.
Do you think they ever will be?
When they die, perhaps.
Are they still in positions of influence?
Definitely.
Might be another story for another day here.
John also ran the Commonwealth Heads of Government meetings for Malcolm Fraser during his term as PM.
And I worked for Fraser for 2 years, which for me was not an enjoyable experience, really. Bob Hawke succeeded him, and it was like the sun coming out.
He arranged VIP visits for Hawke, the most high-profile being the 1983 tour of Australia by a newlywed Prince Charles and Diana, Princess of Wales. He even got to nurse a baby Prince William. Administrator of Norfolk Island was John's last official job, a quiet end to a remarkable career, and the least likely place to get caught in the middle of a geopolitical shitstorm. That was until the Rainbow Warrior was bombed.
I got a call from New Zealand, from their Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they wanted clearance for the New Zealand aircraft to land about 5 p.m. that Monday, carrying 7 New Zealand detectives to arrest or to incarcerate 3 or 4 French citizens who were involved in the explosion.
John convened a meeting with the island's top officials and police. He learned that the Uvea was already moored at Cascade and that Dr. Xavier Manigay had just departed on the flight to Sydney.
I rang Sydney straight away, and he was arrested there and held for 2 days and questioned. The second thing I did was check out where the yacht was, which was on the eastern side of the island, in a reasonably secluded anchorage, but I wanted to find out whether there's anybody still on board. So we left a sentry there. I had the Zodiac, which they used to get from the yacht to the shore. I had that stolen and hidden away. And then we tracked the three French ex-SAS.
What were John's instructions from the Australian government while all this was going on?
Hayden was the Minister for Foreign Affairs and said, look, I've arrested these guys and I'm going to lead a search party at dawn tomorrow morning aboard the yacht to see if there's any trace of explosives that they're carrying. I got back a rather surprising answer saying, do it, but please do not shoot or hurt anybody, which I had no intention of doing.
John's recollection of his conversations with Bill Hayden remind me of something journalist Chris Masters told me about the view of Australia's foreign minister at the time.
He told me, look, this is the story. This is the realpolitik. You know, we just do not have the clout to stand up to big nations like France.
When I first spoke with John on the phone about coming to see him, he said that Bill Hayden was wetting his pants about getting France offside.
It was patently obvious that he was worried stiff that something monumental could come out of this. And the last thing Australia wanted to be done was caught between friendly sources on a matter in which they weren't involved.
Did you think these are the guys, these guys were involved?
Oh, without a doubt.
Still, it was made clear to John that the Kiwis would need to work fast to hold them.
And then I rang our Attorney General, his department, to find out how long under international law could I hold the French. And it was only, I found out, for 24 hours. So I told the New Zealanders that if they couldn't come up with a definite reason for an arrest, I would have to let them go. The Australian government concurred with that as well. And both governments were very, very wary because on one side, New Zealand depended on France for its sales of mutton and beef and agricultural objects. And I found out that the French Prime Minister had rung the New Zealand Prime Minister and was putting the pressure on him to have the French SAS people released. Australia was also involved because of New Zealand's policy of no nuclear cooperation and no visits by foreign warships if they were nuclear, which didn't go down well with the Americans and, of course, was against our policy.
Lots going on at high levels behind the scenes, just like I suspected.
Did you get the impression from Foreign Affairs and Hayden and the Attorney General's department that Australia, we didn't want to have a dog in this fight, that would be good for these guys to get off the island as quick as possible?
I'm sure there was an element of that. Nobody put it in writing, though. But, of course, it was told to me that it could be a matter of acute embarrassment to the government if anything went wrong with the deal.
I could have kept talking with John for hours, but his wife, Joan, is preparing lunch.
How are we for time, darling?
Oh, well, probably about half an hour.
For a nuclear power like France, having two secret agents serving long jail sentences in a minnow country like New Zealand was beyond embarrassing. Almost immediately after the pair were sentenced, France started to turn the screws on the Kiwis to force their release. In February 1986, France tested the waters by announcing a ban on lamb's brain exports. The trade war soon escalated as France banned New Zealand fish, canned kiwi fruit and lamb. The United Nations offered to mediate an outcome in the middle of 1986. As a result of the mediation, in 1987, Alain Maffar and Dominique Prieur were taken to the French Polynesian island Hau
to serve a further 3 years of their sentence. In return, New Zealand received about $13 million from France. Maurice Witham fills me in on the details.
Dominique Prieur's husband was allowed to come over from France. Within a short time, she became pregnant, and because of the complications with pregnancy, she had to go back to France. Unfortunately, Alain Lafar developed a severe gastro problem, which he didn't have in New Zealand, and had to go back for treatment. And they were commended and promoted and given service medals and all the like.
How did that make you feel, personally?
Sick. They were treated as heroes. All our work was down the drain.
Geraldine was among the throng of journalists there for day one of what she expected to be a marathon trial.
It was over in 5 minutes. It astounded me that two governments thought so little of their national sovereignty that they didn't run this down to the maximum extent allowable. It was an incredible affront, I think, to New Zealand sovereignty. And you'd think that, you know, given that these guys were on Australian territory and the police actually had them.
As we know, the Rainbow Warrior bombing took place at a time when America and Australia were annoyed with the Kiwis for rejecting visiting US nuclear-armed warships. Those bloody New Zealanders were putting their do-gooder idealism ahead of Western security interests during the Cold War period. I did some more digging in the National Archive to see if I could learn more about the dynamic between Australia and New Zealand back then, and found some fascinating stuff that hasn't been made public until now. Like senior New Zealand foreign affairs officials in 1986 secretly briefing Australian diplomats on their private discussions with Kiwi Prime Minister David Longhi over his plans to introduce nuclear-free legislation. The Australians learned that Longhi was toying with delaying the new laws because he feared more retaliation from the United States. Journalist Nikki Hagar has done a power of work on the secret history of the Kiwis' nuclear-free campaign. His investigations uncovered a network of faceless men in defence and foreign affairs who wanted to preserve the alliance with the US and leave behind the nuclear-free policy, which they deemed childish.
The officials were so angry at losing that three out of four of the main ones wrote books about it later to talk about how wrong Longhi had been and how ridiculous the New Zealand public had been not to accept their wise advice. It's pretty extraordinary reading. I recommend it to people who are interested in foreign policy as a case study of the way that officials who would always hold their hands in polite ways and say, we just follow the directions of our governments, are very capable of running concerted campaigns within the full secret cooperation of their allies.
In August 1987, Australian diplomats received a confidential cable from Canberra in response to a speech by New Zealand's United Nations representative, Graham Fortune. I've had an actor read parts of the cable.
Wellington and Geneva are asked to give a low-key warning to the New Zealanders about growing indications of a New Zealand government wish to proselytise for its anti-nuclear policies.
The Kiwis told the Aussies they were trying to respect Western security interests while still delivering on their anti-nuclear promises. The Australians weren't buying it.
We sought to make clear to him that we thought that objective unachievable and that we certainly have no interest in assisting New Zealand in this endeavour. Mr. Hayden has agreed that you should convey the same low-key warning to appropriate New Zealand officials. Mr. Hayden also agreed that we should tell the Americans what we've done.
That line tells us who's boss here. Nikki Hagar again.
Australia was, in effect, having a job at that stage, which it continues to have, of overseeing New Zealand's contributions to the alliance.
The cable finished with another instruction from Hayden.
We should watch alertly for any serious manifestations of a New Zealand tendency to proselytise internationally.
For me, this document is a prime example of Australia playing deputy sheriff for the Americans in the South Pacific to intimidate New Zealand. By 1988, the pressure from Australia and the US seemed to be working. New Zealand officials were backgrounding their Australian counterparts about a policy shift in the second term of the Longy government. This is part of a restricted cable sent to Canberra in March 1988.
The reasons for this policy shift were largely related to trade concerns and also involved pressure from the United States and the feeling that if New Zealand wanted to be taken more seriously in its involvement in the multilateral disarmament process, it would have to be seen to be less eccentric to its approach in international security issues.
I asked Nikki about the contents of these diplomatic cables and how they made him feel as a
Kiwi. It's an unattractive picture of how Australia regards us, how the Australian official government world regards us, which doesn't feel like as equals.
That said, Nikki says most New Zealanders remain proud of their anti-nuclear stance, a policy that remains in place to this day.
It can't be changed by whatever government is there because it's so strong. Yeah, Australia missed out on doing the same thing.
Hello?
Hello, Alice. This is Richard. How are you?
Hey, fine. And you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, great.
I got in touch with Alice, as Etienne, my French contact, suggested. I'm hoping she can find one of the agents from the Uvea.
And do you know how old is he?
I would say now he would be in his mid-60s, maybe 70.
Okay.
Yeah. He's quite old.
Okay.
Yeah.
To spray all these secrets.
Alice gets to work and comes back soon to tell me the security firm the man has been working for is no longer operational. She's contacted the owner of the firm, but he won't put us in contact with the man. I also messaged the man privately via his LinkedIn. While I was working with Alice, I found another Uvea crew member in the database of an international sporting body. True to form, this man of action is still competing for France, despite being in his early 70s. I contacted the sporting body's administration and asked if they could forward an email to him. I trust that they did, but again, no reply. Alice was able to put me in touch with someone who's interviewed one of the French Navy divers.
What's the story? The story it is. First, there is a book called Opération Oxygène.
Hervé Brissini is a famous French television investigative reporter and media executive with more than 40 years in the game. The book he's telling me about, Operation Oxygène, caused a stir in France when it was published in 1987.
The author is Patrick Dumont-Nevers.
Patrick Dumont-Nevers is actually a pseudonym for flamboyant French author and artist, Patrick Amery. The reason his book caused such a fuss is because it contained secret information about the Rainbow Warrior mission, particularly events concerning our friends on the Uvea.
And he was a spectacular guy, and he makes the friendship with the men of the DGAC. He wrote that book to describe the operation of the boat who called Uvea.
The information was so precise that he almost certainly had to have been extensively briefed by either Verge, Bartolo or Andres. The trio were still serving members of the French naval divers and DGSE operatives. To spill inside information to an author was an extremely risky move. Hervé interviewed the author live on air on France's public broadcaster.
He says, yes, I'm a friend of the agent. I know so much things. And it was difficult for him to describe, to speak about that operation. We had a discussion and we agree, both, about what he can say.
Bervet convinced the DGSE agent to record an interview, subject to a few conditions.
I change his voice. Also, when I make that interview, I was in front of the camera and he was in back, but with fake hair. So he speaks and in fact, he says that he's very angry because his feeling is to be betrayed by his government, by Mitterrand, because they have a revelation of the identities.
Hervé's talking about the publication of Verge, Barthelot and André's true identities, as well as those of Alain Maffar and Dominique Prieur, in the whitewash report by Bernard Tricot. Hervé returned to Paris with a dynamite interview to drop into France's heated political environment.
My director decided to broadcast my interview. But at this moment, there is a very important political moment because it was election. And some people was thinking that I was manipulated. And it was a very a terrible moment for me.
I found a recording of Hervé's interview with the DGSE agent. This is what went to air.
Vous avez choisi de garder l'anonymat, de rester dans l'ombre. Pourquoi?
Je garde l'anonymat. Parce que je suis un agent de la DGSE. Ma vie est liée au secret.
Vous décidez pour.
The French government reacted immediately, launching an investigation to identify the DGSE agent. For a few days, Hervé thought his career was over.
It was like a nightmare. Every day it was like a trial. The defense minister say that we arrest the men who are speaking at the French TV. They put in jail. And after that, some people told me, you are finished, man. Your career is over.
But the cloud over him soon passed. The author of Operation Oxygène, Patrick Dumont-Ver, was sued by some of the politicians and intelligence officials he wrote about. He subsequently claimed his work was a fictional account inspired by real events. But as we'll discover in our next and final episode, the other member of the Uvea crew, Dr. Xavier Manigay, had no doubt that Dumont-Ver and Hervé had been talking to one of his fellow crew members, a man he came to regard as the ultimate snitch.
I think is also what actually happened when they left Norfolk. They just disappeared.
He said to me, if I had known that there would have been a dead man, I would never have been involved in such an affair.
A snitch is the traitor from within, an informer from within.